Good evening and welcome. You're watching Left, Right and Center. I'm Vishnu Shom on the program tonight. The latest in what is being seen to be one of the most striking reverses in modern warfare. Ukraine's army, which was sustaining incredible losses, appears to have turned the tide on the Russians, capturing, some estimates say, as much as 6,000 square kilometers of territory in the east and in the south of the country. The pace at which this has happened, and it just about started since the beginning of this month, that's truly incredible. In fact, it's going to be studied for years to come. How has this happened? Are Russian forces truly on the run in the east of the country? Can Ukraine keep up with its offensive? Are their soldiers now tired and are their logistics lines strained? What about Russia? Is this a tactical retreat? Pushed to a corner, how will Russia react? Is there even a possible threat of the use of nuclear weapons? Is this the beginning of the end of the war, or is this merely a new phase? So many questions. Let's try and get you an explainer on what the situation on the ground is, and also then try and explain to you what the Russian losses have been, because that's stupendous in a way of speak. And the question therefore being asked is, how long can they sustain this? Well, the astonishing speed of the Ukrainian counterattack in Ukraine has been so much that Ukraine has been able to regain, as I mentioned, 6,000 square kilometers of territory in a matter of days. In town after town that they've been recapturing, Ukrainian soldiers have been flying their flags. For Russia, the astounding reversal indicates that this is at best a tactical retreat, at worst a defeat in the east of the country, where they had spent many months gaining territory. That's now gone in days, the biggest single defeat since they were forced to withdraw from the north of Kiev, the Ukrainian capital. Now, on this map, the areas in the east and in the south are the areas that we're going to be actually looking at. So what we can now do is actually circle the Kharkiv area, and that's what we're going to be looking at very, very closely. This is all based on the Institute of the Study of War and what they've come out with. Now, here's a close-up of the area. You can see Kharkiv marked in red. These are the areas where the Ukrainian forces have advanced. The blue areas are territory that they have actually recaptured. This is the critical town of Kupiansk that they have recaptured, and they have now also recaptured Izium. It's taken the Russians earlier on a month to have captured Izium, but the Ukrainians have taken just a couple of days. So what does this all mean? Well, I think it also needs to be looked at in terms of the context of the Russian losses in the Ukraine war. Firstly, the disproportionate number of generals who've been killed. At least 8 generals have been killed on the field. The number of troops dead or injured estimated at 80,000 by the Pentagon. Military equipment destroyed or damaged, nearly 6,000 pieces. Of that, tanks destroyed or damaged or lost, more than 1,000. Armored vehicles destroyed, damaged or lost, 527. Infantry vehicles destroyed, damaged or lost, more than 1,100. Trucks, nearly 1,500. Naval ships destroyed, including a cruiser, 8. Aircraft lost, 53. Helicopters lost, 49. Now, these are fairly conservative numbers and don't take into account what has actually been taking place in the last couple of days. These numbers will be updated when that actually happens. So I'm going to introduce my panel at this stage. Jack Detch, the national security reporter at Foreign Policy, joins us. We've also got Brahma Chilani, the strategic affairs expert. And we've also got Ingrid Kim, a Russian journalist. And we're joined by two Ukrainian MPs as well, Solomia Bobrovska and Sviatoslav Yurash. I'd like to thank you all very much for being with us. Let me come to you first, Jack. What explains the pace of the Ukrainian advance?
I think it's just the weakness of the Russian defenses. When talking to Ukrainian and American officials, what they saw as they approached these positions with wheeled offensive attacks, something that the Ukrainians didn't have on their arsenal on February 24th, were Rusgardia, police Svetsnaz, people who had been trained up very, very quickly to fight and were prepared to fight. So instead of really facing a toe-to-toe battle here, the Ukrainians saw a lot of these folks just withdrawing from their lines, collapsing as they advanced, especially as the Russians couldn't really do a one-for-one and hold both sides of the battlefield in the midst of this southern advance that the Ukrainians have also been working on. So we've really seen just a collapse of these Russian forces, a collapse of Russian personnel, and it's going to be difficult to see how the Russians will be able to make up that ground until January as Putin begins that mobilization of over 130,000 more troops.
And Jack, is that inevitable, that given the losses that they've sustained, Russia has to get into a conscription model?
It could be so. I mean, certainly they've already announced the plans to mobilize 130,000 more folks. Putin, of course, and the Russian leadership have stepped aside from a general mobilization because this is very politically tricky.
Yep.
If they actually do declare a general mobilization, this steps away from being the special operation that the Kremlin has very carefully tailored and leans into more of a full-scale war, which could be politically costly for the Kremlin at home. So if Putin decides to do that, he has to weigh mm-hmm. that very carefully against the needs of the Russian public and the possible backlash if more Russian troops are coming home in caskets.
Jack, you know, there's been talk about the attack on Kherson in the south for more than a month now, and of course it is happening. But is it just enough to say that, look, the Russians truly bought the Ukrainian ploy of getting them to redeploy their forces to the south of the country, abandon positions in the east, or make them weaker by moving forces down? Or is this a failure of Russian satellites to see intelligence on the ground failing, soldiers having morale, which is very low, and equipment losses?
The Ukrainians insist this wasn't a bluff, that they were actually pushing on both fronts. What seemed to have happened, though, was as the losses got more intense in the south, as this became a more entrenched artillery battle, and the Russians really had to reinforce those lines after sustaining the HIMARS assault from the U.S. guns that were provided to the Ukrainians, the artillery assault, eventually it just seemed to become too much to manage, and we saw that collapse. But this was very, very carefully planned between the Ukrainians, American and British officials. The Ukrainians, of course, have always wanted to go further. The Americans, the Brits, the Europeans have been urging caution. But here it seems like the Ukrainians ran into a situation where the defenses were so weak, they were really able to push very far, very quickly, and just a much more skilled military than what we saw back in February.
Yep. Let's go across to Solomia Bobrovska. She's a member of parliament in Ukraine. Thank you very much for being with us. Solomia, my question is this. Have there been very large surrenders of Russian forces in the south and in the east so far?
Yes, I would say that Russians remain their armed forces and their concentration of armed forces on that directions. And even though we are now having the victory on the Kharkiv direction and see how fast moving the Ukrainian armed forces, but still on Donetsk and Kherson regions, Russian soldiers are still trying to attack, and the majority of the armed forces concentrated on that direction, on that lines. So even though I'm optimist about Kharkiv situation, I'm still very careful about Donetsk and south, I think we have to pay attention on that as well, despite the good news from our Ukrainian armed forces.
Svetoslav Yurash, again, it's a similar question. Based on what we are hearing, and we aren't very sure, which is why I'm asking, have there been large surrenders of Russian forces in the south and in the east, or have they actually gone away? Have they escaped, or are they surrendering to you?
We have seen footage from the Russian soldiers that were captured in an offensive around Kharkiv. As I'm reporting to you now from currently at, the fact of the matter is Russians haven't surrendered to the first day of the war. Russians don't really know what they are doing. Many of their soldiers who have essentially been sent here to be killed don't want to die because they don't support. So that's why, of course, they are surrendering. But it's far from what is needed for a full-scale collapse of the so-called second biggest army in the world. And we will certainly be pushing for so much more as this war will go on to showcase in the world just how empty are Russian threats and Russian world.
Dr. Chilani, a lot of people would suggest that it's in this situation that perhaps Putin is most dangerous. There is unconventional warfare as well. There's a threat of nuclear weapons, a tactical nuclear weapon. That's a big worry. Do you believe that's realistic, or do you believe that Putin is going to go the course and try and extend this on conventional lines, if at all?
Putin cannot afford to emerge as a loser from his Ukraine military operation, because that would unravel his power base at home. He has been facing rising criticism at home for his handling of the war. But to answer your question, there is a growing risk, even if a remote one, that the current Russian-US proxy conflict could slide into direct conflict, a scenario that in turn would raise the risk of a nuclear exchange. So there is definitely a risk. But I think to look at the larger picture, it's too early to judge how Putin's invasion is going, as truth is the first casualty in the fog of war. There's an ongoing information war by different parties, and that information war is helping to obscure the actual facts. It's unclear, for example, what led to the Russian military setbacks last weekend. The setbacks didn't result from tank battles or other bloody combat. So what led to the sudden and abrupt Russian retreat? That remains an unanswered question. The Americans, for their part, are crediting the weapons they supplied, especially the HIMAR rocket system, for having an outsized effect on the battlefield. If superior firepower failed to avert American defeat in Afghanistan just a year ago, it is too much to expect American weaponry to turn the tide in the Ukraine war. But I think one important point that we have to keep in mind is that despite the latest Russian setbacks, about one-fifth of Ukraine remains under Russian occupation. And that's a lot of territory.
Yes, of
because
course.
Ukraine is the largest country located entirely within Europe. So we have to see the setback in context.
Salome, let me ask you this. What is the situation of people in Izium or Kupiansk right now? Have there been a lot of people who've actually fled to the Russian side? Is there still some fighting happening in those areas? Have you been able to open up, for example, roads to these areas, to these cities of yours?
Yes, there are normal roads still to that areas, and the big press trip was organized just today, and we will see the fresh photos, and actually we see the fresh broadcast from armed forces, and fresh photos will be from the biggest newspapers and sites. But about the civilians, I would say, honestly, the part, unfortunately, took the Russian passports, and they decided and agreed to be under in collaboration with the Russian occupation administration. And that's what our now security service is doing, putting them in the list and putting them in a jail, as it is according to the Ukrainian law. But the numerous photos and videos, what we see, how civilians were waiting for their for the deoccupation and for the armed forces. And I hope that that was a true lesson for Kherson region, for Donetsk region, for Zaporizhia region, what will be after deoccupation. So who decided to work under in collaboration with the occupied administration?
Sure.
They have to pay by law and by rules. I would assure all people maybe who may be watching this that when we be back home to Mariupol, to Donetsk and so on, I hope the people still waiting, and I know how they are waiting. And the resistance now, which is working on that occupied terrorist, show really good work. And I hope armed forces will finally meet them by their own.
Okay. Ingrid Kim, let me try and see if we can get her back. Ingrid, can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you very, very,
Great. Ingrid, why has there been no reaction so far from Putin on the losses in the east of the country?
I hear you very badly. Can you please be louder?
Why is there any reaction on from the Russian government on the loss of territory in eastern Ukraine?
First of all, I think it's not still finished. It's too contentious, so it's difficult to accept that it was lost or it's still going on this military conflict. So I cannot state it. I'm not on behalf of the government of Russia, but I can say there is a different version of Ukrainian media, which is to use their own facts, and Russian media. So very controversial.
Okay. Jack, let me come back to you. What strikes me is the stunning loss or inability of Russian air power to control the ground situation or help to control the ground situation in the east of the country. Without the support of the Russian Air Force, the Ukrainians have just literally waltzed into this area. What happened to the Russian Air Force?
It's been one of the biggest mysteries of the war, Vishnu, from the perspective of Western and U.S. officials. It just seems that the command and control, as has fallen apart throughout the Russian military in this conflict, just hasn't been there for Russian air power. And so we've just seen it really take an absent role. Now, of course, this region abuts the Western Russian military district, which has significant firepower and presence in terms of S-300s and S-400s. So you would think it would be a more permissive area for those aircraft to operate, but we just haven't seen them present. And certainly that's just given the Ukrainians a tremendous leg up with the mobility that they have now, with the firepower that they have now, and with the skies not being a present factor here. The Ukrainians have just been able to roll through, as you said.
Yeah. Mr. Yurash, do you believe that this is the beginning of the end of this conflict, or do you believe that this is a new phase of the conflict? It's too early to say that this is the beginning of the end.
We have proven the Russians. We beat them around our capital when they made bleak and we put up the sea in the end of February. We defeated them in Sumy, Chernihiv, north of the country. We are beating them back from Kharkiv right now. We'll beat back them from the rest of the country. Our country will be ours, and there is no two ways about it. We will restore our country's sovereignty, and Russia will leave us alone. Whether it will do so willingly or forcefully, we will take our country back.
Mr. Yurash, you know, we've spoken many times, including in Kiev in the past. I'm just trying to understand, what is the timeline? Is there a timeline which is realistically possible? Or do you believe that, you know, this can stretch on indefinitely?
The truth is, the answer for that lies in the Kremlin. As soon as Kremlin decides to leave us alone, to decide our own future, our own destiny, we will do so. The point is that we will fight on until Kremlin thinks that our country doesn't exist and thinks it can decide our future. That we disagree on, that we shall fight. And the point here is that basically since our conversations back at that point, we have been thinking about winning. And we shall be proving this time and time again. I am right now in the south of Ukraine, and believe me, here you will see many more surprises in the weeks and months to come. So again, we shall be proving the facts on the ground that we will choose our own destiny, and only us.
Jack, you know, there's obviously a lot of hype about certain weapon systems, and we know that, you know, sometimes it's important not to get too attracted to funky new technology. But it has to be said that the HIMARS system has given the Ukrainians, it appears, a qualitative edge in targeting, something that they were unable to do in the face of very oppressive Russian artillery attacks for several months. How has this one combat system potentially changed the face of the war in some parts of Ukraine?
Vishnu, I think it's the accuracy of this system, that it's able to fire high precision rounds into Russian positions, and the planning that Ukrainian and Western officials have done to map out Russian targets specifically linked to their supply and command and control centers. So they've been hitting top military officers. They've been hitting ammunition dumps in the south. Of course, the attacks on the military base in Crimea. This is specifically designed to degrade Russian capability to wage war. So we see them less capable, more isolated, less able to actually sustain the fight. And so as the Russians keep going against this Ukrainian onslaught, they're less capable and less capable going forward. Now, that's not a sort of a one-size-fits-all solution to the conflict here, because the Ukrainians are low on ammunition by their own account on this system. They're low on ammunition for the 152 Soviet-era artillery systems, which are just dwindling because a lot of those stocks are produced by the Russians themselves, and they need to get more of the 155 ammunition that's produced by NATO allies, but it's just not coming online fast enough. So even though we've seen these tremendous gains, the pressure is coming from the Ukrainians on Western officials, on the United States. They're in Washington right now, demanding more weapons and faster.
Solomia, we've seen a couple of attacks by the Russians on power facilities in the Kharkiv area, large areas of your country are going through a blackout. And then there's the entire concern about the nuclear facilities in Zaporizhia. Is that a real concern that, a nuclear power plant, one of the largest in the world, could actually be targeted to devastating effect, and B, that Russia is now going after your power infrastructure?
Yes, actually, it's one of our biggest concern. That's a nuclear power plant station, and it's stopping its work. And first of all, and then this autumn and winter seems to be one of the hardest. Because we expect the shelling of the facilities that will be the main target, not even the military infrastructure, but the civilian facilities and critical infrastructure, electricity, heating of the apartments, and so on. And we can only imagine what we saw what happened actually in Kharkiv when it almost the blackout was done, and the same could happen in Kyiv, in the capital, or whatever in other Ukrainian cities. And we expect the Russians will do this, and that's how they will make one of the options to press on Ukraine to sit around the table of a new round of negotiations. And actually, that would be one of the challenges, one of the threats to Ukraine. And of course, Zaporizhia power plant station. We didn't hear actually from international organization their final report on right. What's going on the power plant station in Zaporizhia, in Energodar. Yeah. And we're afraid, even though it will be out of the electricity and stopped for 100%, right. We're afraid of the results of its stopping of its work.
All right. Well, I'd like to thank you all very much for joining us. It's fascinating at one level how a much smaller military force has overcome the might of Russia. But the question marks still remain on how exactly this has happened. And I think to the question on whether this is a new chapter of this conflict or this is the beginning of the end, some would suggest that this is a new chapter because Russia may not have played its final cards. But it's quite clear that for Russia to regain this territory, which the Ukrainians have taken over, that's going to be extremely difficult given the state of their armed forces deployed on the ground. We'll take a short break. More coming up.